Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, August 9th, 2023, on 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. I'm coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprouts. You can also check out my Facebook page, X, and Instagram at Fran Storch ND. I said it. It's not
the
Twitter.
Heck is that?
It's X. I don't know if it's still called Twitter, but the symbol is
no,
just X.
No, it's called X. It's called X now.
Really?
Yeah, it is.
Did you read that somewhere?
Yeah,
somewhere?
I did. Oh. Yeah. It's X. I would say we need to X it all out of our lives. What do you think? X it. Get it?
Exit. X needs to
right.
exit.
Right.
Okay. I suppose. All right. So so let's give you an update of what's going on in the world. Right now, it's raining here in beautiful Mansfield Hollow, and it's raining at a steady pace. It's not extreme, and there's no thunder and lightning, but it's coming down steadily. And it actually, if you look outside and, you know, smell the air and listen, it actually sounds soothing. It's really not bad. I mean, we had two really gorgeous days, Saturday and Sunday, and I am sadly still off the bike, but happily trying to enjoy the summer in other ways, you know, by doing summer things. I'm still suffering from that herniated disc. We have gravity chairs in the back, which are not special chairs for your back. They're just lounge chairs that happen to be gravity chairs. And if you do have a back injury, they're really nice to sit in. So I've been making use of those and using them to sunbathe. I'm very grateful to a friend of mine who is letting me use his pool, and I went into his pool yesterday. His pool is immaculately clean, which is, you know, sort of neither here nor there. It's very different from going in some of the lakes. But I really, really appreciate it because he's like, come over whenever you want. He's really, really gracious to me. Yesterday, I brought them peaches, and then yesterday, also, big shout out to Saul Nesselroth, who celebrated his 96th birthday on July 17th, 2023. And we were going to celebrate his birthday at the Red Barn, as we usually do every year, on July 16th. But it was a really bad weather day, and nobody wanted to ride bikes or even drive because there was a tornado watch anyway. So that didn't happen. And so we postponed it, and because of life, we had to postpone it to this weekend, but I figured, you know, he's going to be 96 all year, so any weekend works. So we arranged it to go yesterday, and again, I can't ride my bike, so I drove over and met everybody, and that was very nice. And we got to, so big shout out to Renee at the Red Barn, who helped to arrange this, and big shout out to all the people who showed up, and we had a nice time. And then after I was done at the Red Barn, I drove over to my friend's house and used the pool, and that was great. So I got some sunshine, I got some cool water, I got to float around in the pool. And the other thing is that a week ago, it was July 31st, so it was not yet the days between. So the days between are what we deadheads call the days in August, starting on August 1st and ending on August 9th. August 1st, 1942, is Jerry Garcia's birthday, and August 9th, 1995, is the day of Jerry Garcia's passing. So we celebrate those days by just listening to a lot of Dead music and appreciating Grateful Dead, and especially appreciating Jerry. What was really cool is we saw our friend Jerry at the farmer's market yesterday, and our friend Jerry happens to be a big Grateful Dead fan, and he was wearing his Cats Under the Stars t-shirt, and Cats Under the Stars is specifically a Jerry Garcia band album. So Jerry was wearing a Jerry shirt during the days between. So that was pretty cool. I thought that was auspicious. So we had a nice time. Did you have a nice time on your bike rides?
Yes, we did. Yeah. We did. We had a great time.
That's good. And the weather was just lovely yesterday. It was low humidity. It got up into the 80s, so it was comfortable for swimming. It was still, when I was lying in the sun late yesterday afternoon, I got sweaty. And then when the sun sank below the trees, it got really comfortable in the yard. It's really nice to hang out there. So, you know, those lazy, relaxing summer days, and, you know, it's going to start to cool off. So I'm trying to enjoy it as much as I can. getting back to, we're going to talk a lot about inflammation today, and one of the things I'll just update you on my poor back. And so Ron and I keep learning things about the back. So yesterday we were watching a video, a very helpful fellow. His name is Will Harlow, and he's on YouTube. And Will Harlow is a physical therapist in England, which means he's not a physical therapist, he's a physiotherapist. That's what they call them over there. And he's in the town of Farnham, which is to the southwest of London. So it's starting to get down towards, I guess, Cornwall and the south coastline, but not quite. Anyway, that's where he is. He's very smart, and he gives very good advice. And he works with people with herniated discs all the time, and he does physical therapy for people who are past 55. And so he had some very good advice. So I learned what yoga poses you're not supposed to do. And then he said, he also told us things that you shouldn't do in general, or that you should do in general, to help you get better faster from a herniated disc. So one of the things we learned is that you should exercise. And he said, even if you have pain, you should exercise. However, you should not exercise through. Those are two different things that he said. One is that he said you should keep exercising, but you exercise in a way that does not cause you pain. And he said, specifically, you should walk. So today when I go to physical therapy, I'm going to talk to my physical therapist about, well, should I walk? Because what he says to do is walk. If you get to a point of pain, stop, rest, get yourself out of the pain, and then keep going. I'm sure he doesn't mean go for a 3-mile hike. I'm sure he means like 20 to 30 minutes or something like that, or maybe less. I don't know. So I'll find out today because I'm going to ask my physical therapist. So I'm starting physical. This is the first day that I'm going to do that modality, physical therapy. So I'm looking very much forward to it because I'm a person who will exercise unless you tell me not to. And I'm continuing to, all right, how about a little of this? How about a little of this? And Ron's like, be careful. But one of the things that I have learned is that I have more pain when I wake up in the morning and I don't want to get out of bed. That's why it takes me so long to get out of bed, because it hurts. And then what I need to realize is that, yes, it hurts first thing in the morning. Why? Because your secretions are pooling at the site of the herniation. And if I would just get up and start moving around, I would feel better, which is in fact what happened today. That I was having more pain in my butt, you know, the radicular pain that goes into your tuchus. And so when I finally got up and walked around and stretched a little bit, and then I put some salves on, you know, my different salves that I have, my salve that has comfrey and goldenrod and rutabaga graveolens, my other salve that has hot things like ginger, cayenne, cardamom, and rosemary. I put those on and it felt better, you know. And I have another one that has menthol in it, so they're all on me. And at night I have a salve that has CBD in it, and so I use that in the evening. Has a lot of menthol and a bunch of CBD, and that feels really nice at night. So I do that, and nice and relaxing. What I could be doing is taking more CBD. You have more CBD, like gummies and gels and stuff?
A whole bunch in there.
Let's break those out and I'll
you should
hit
have
them at
those.
Night.
Okay, yeah. You should hit
okay.
them.
Okay, so I'm going to do that. And remember that CBD, cannabidiol, does not make you high. It just makes you relaxed, and it can help with pain. So those were among the things that we learned. Another thing that we learned is that, you know, one of the things I'm learning is that you need to avoid forward flexion. So you need to avoid flexing your spine forward. And one of the ways that people tend to flex their spine is when they're sitting at a computer. And so I have to figure out how to not flex my spine so much when I'm doing that. And I'm going to try to be more mindful about standing up more and just like standing up when I'm talking to my patients. But also something he said, I have a pillow behind my back right now. But the other thing that he said that was really useful is get a towel and put a rolled up towel in the small of your back so that it helps to exaggerate your lumbar lordosis. Because one of the things you want to do is you don't want to be in flexion, and it does feel better when you arch your back. So when you extend, that's back extension. That's called back extension. So if you're doing a yoga pose and you're on all fours, that would be the cow pose. And again, you don't do the cat pose. Instead of doing cat and cow, you do flatten cow. So I was talking to my friend Christian yesterday, and he said a really good pose to do is cobra. And when you do the cobra pose, you're pushing yourself up on your hands and you're arching your back in the correct direction. So he's right. And I've seen other videos where not only do you do cobra, you do press ups. So you're going in and out of cobra. And that does feel really nice. So the big things we learned to remind us that is that towel in the small of your back. And even if you don't have a herniated disc, if you get sore from sitting at a computer all day, if you already have a cushion there, great, but consider putting a rolled up towel behind your back or it could be a round bolster, but a cylindrical bolster, so that it exaggerates your lumbar lordosis and that will keep your spine in its normal lumbar lordosis. The thing is, you tend to herniate. Herniations tend to happen posterolaterally. So what that means is if you're bending forward, you put a lot of pressure on the front of your discs and stuff tends to come out the back because you spend so much time hunched forward. And so they can't come back directly. They can't come back directly posterolaterally because the spinal column is in the way. But so what they do is they tend to leach out posterolaterally. So behind and to the side. And guess what's on the side? The exit of the nerve roots from the foramen. So then the nerve roots, annulus pulposus will, or not the annulus pulposus, the annulus will break and then it will leak out nucleus pulposus, which is that jelly-like substance, and then it sits on the nerve roots and then it causes your inflammation. And so so you have a couple things going on there. That nucleus pulposus is sitting on the nerve roots. Itself, it's irritating the nerve roots and putting pressure on it. And then your body looks at it and goes, you're not supposed to be there, and starts making inflammatory compounds. And that's where you get your pain. And the other thing that's happening is your body goes, you know, nucleus pulposus, you're supposed to be inside the spine. You're not supposed to be outside the spine. What are you doing there? And so your immune system has chemotaxis, which means it looks at that glob of nucleus pulposus, that gel that's sticking out, and it calls forth blood cells called macrophages. So when they're in your blood, they're called monocytes, and when they leave your blood, they change their name and they get called macrophages. And macrophages are the garbage men of your trash collectors of your body. Whereas things like neutrophils are white blood cells that will go after viruses and bacteria, and lymphocytes get encoded to fight after viruses, bacteria, parasites, and allergens. Monocytes and macrophages are kind of nonspecific. So if you have an infection, if you get a cold or you get a bronchitis or something, and when you're done the bronchitis, you've got neutrophils and lymphocytes that are going after the microbes. And then you have a battlefield because you have dead neutrophils and you have mucus and you have scar tissue and you have dead cells because your body waged a war against the microorganism. So the macrophage's job is to go in there and clean up the mess. And so macrophages are going to leave your blood cells. They're called monocytes when they're in the blood, and they leave your blood cells. They have to because you don't really have a good blood supply to the discs. So the macrophages will go and leave circulation and go right to the extruded nucleus pulposus and start cleaning it up. And when that happens, there's inflammatory compounds that happen. So you have pain. And so my understanding, once again, is that you can get surgery, you can get injections, but if you can manage the pain, you might as well wait it out. I saw a good video from a gentleman named Dr. Shim. It was a very good 5-minute video, and he explained exactly how it worked with a lot of visuals. And you saw the visuals, right?
I did. That was actually really, he had some good props.
That was Will Harlow. He had some good props. But Dr. Shim had some good visuals as well. And he explained that if you get surgery, the surgery and waiting it out have about the same outcome. So if you can wait it out and manage the pain, you still get to be in your life. You still get to work. You still get to exercise. And you're not, you don't have the risks of surgery. And you don't, and among the risks of surgery are the risks of surgery itself. You have to go under anesthesia, which is always dangerous. I mean, if you have a good anesthesiologist, probably nothing will happen, but stuff could happen. Going under general anesthesia is always a risk. You can avoid that. That's a good thing. And whenever somebody cuts into you, you have to heal from that, and you have scar tissue, and you can get scarring in your spine where they did the surgery, and that can cause problems later on. Your body can heal this stuff, and especially, you know, especially if you take care of yourself the right way, you know, and you don't do anything much to aggravate it, your body will clean it up over time. And that's what I have to have faith in. It's just that the waiting, let's sing it together. The waiting is the hardest part. Yeah, good old Tom Petty. Right,
good old Tom.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's what's going on with me. I still have pain. I think it's getting... Do you feel like I'm behaving as though it's improving?
Yes.
Okay. So that's good to know.
Yeah, it's a little better.
A little bit better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking very much forward to physical therapy today and to see how that goes. And if you're watching Facebook Messenger and Instagram, I'm fixing my hair. And why am I fixing my hair? Because when you have curly hair and your hair is wet, you have to finger style it. So you have to make sure the curls separate and it dries it, because I am really great at getting very interesting bedhead styles. I'm trying to have that not happen. And I wanted to wear my hair down for a change, right? Okay, so anyway. All right, so let's talk about inflammation. And I'll keep you posted on what's going and what I learn. And, you know, by next week, I will have had physical therapy and more craniosacral therapy and who knows what else. So and maybe hopefully what I'm hoping for is that physical therapy is going to give me some direction as to what and how to exercise. Maybe they're going to give me some specific exercises, which I look forward to. So I'll tell you about that later. Okay, so let's talk about what in the heck inflammation is. So inflammation is part of what happens when you have an injury. So you can have, so a lot of things can cause inflammation, and inflammation is your body's way, it's what happens when your body is trying to repair things. There's normal inflammation and there's abnormal inflammation. So you can have, so your immune system creates inflammation to protect your body from infection, injury, or disease. And you need inflammation in your body to heal. But there, sometimes you get chronic inflammation. Autoimmune inflammation is not a kind of inflammation that you really want to have. That's when your body is creating an inflammatory response to yourself. And that's not a good thing. Acute inflammation occurs over a short duration, but can be severe. And it should resolve in a couple of weeks or less. And you have acute symptoms. And then your body will restore itself. And that's how your body uses cells. There's chemical reactions in cells that go and fix whatever's going on in your body. If you have chronic inflammation, it's slow, it's less severe, and longer than 6 weeks generally. And it can even occur when there's no injury, and may not end when the injury is healed. So chronic inflammation would be, an example of that would be autoimmunity. So it keeps going on. So there's the five signs of inflammation: heat, pain, redness, swelling, and loss of function. In Latin, in school, we learned it as calor, dolor, rubor, and tumor. And we didn't learn that loss of function was... Those were the four Latin parts of inflammation and loss of function. Loss of function isn't necessary. Loss of function is a... Heat, pain, redness, and swelling are precisely inflammation. Loss of function is what can happen as a result of inflammation. You can have inflammation and not have loss of function. Like, you know, if you have an inflamed nose, you can still breathe. Sometimes you can't, and that's bad. If you have enough inflammation in your lungs because you have asthma or you have acute bronchitis or pneumonia, you can have loss of function. But generally, you don't. If you have a cold, if you have chronic allergies, or if you have, you know, an acute bronchitis, you're generally still breathing. So that's not loss of function, unless they mean reduction in function. So that's true too. All right. So you're going to get specific symptoms depending on your body, where the inflammation is. And long-term inflammation can lead to symptoms, infect your body in a lot of ways. You can have pain. You can have fatigue from inflammation. Why? Because your body sees inflammation as a stress response. And inflammation is governed by cortisol, which is your fight or flight hormone. And you're gonna have extra cortisol around if you have inflammation. And that makes you tired. So it makes you want to sleep more. It can cause chronic inflammation can affect your mood. When you have too much cortisol, it tends to crowd out other happy neurotransmitters like dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin. So you tend to feel sadder and unhappy and irritable and stuff. You can have GI issues just from chronic inflammation. If you have inflammatory compounds running around your body, like I could have, I'm pretty fortunate that this hasn't really affected my GI, except that I would say my appetite is reduced. Probably, sometimes it's because I'm in pain, but most of the time it's because I'm just not moving as much. You know, there's a big difference between riding your bike 100 miles a week and walking around the yard or walking around in the supermarket, and that's pretty much all you're doing, and you know, stretching in the bedroom. So my appetite is a little bit reduced, and I have to be careful because, you know, if I get sad, that means that that sugar could happen. And sugar has happened, unfortunately. And sugar is not a great thing for inflammation. So anyway, you can get, just from having inflammation anywhere in your body, you can get digestive issues. You can gain weight from chronic inflammation. And one of the ways that happens is there's a couple of mechanisms of that. One of them is that you're not moving as much. And the other is, again, when you have chronic inflammation, you have higher cortisol. It's because the cortisol is trying to run your immune system, number one. And number two is that when you have inflammation, you may have pain. That's stressful. And your body will increase your cortisol because it thinks that you're in danger. So when you have higher cortisol, what does cortisol do? It runs around your body. It looks for stuff to break down, put sugar into your blood, and then you're not moving as much, so that sugar can get stored as fat, so you gain weight. You can also get more infections if you have chronic inflammation. So the symptoms can vary on where you're inflamed. So if you have rheumatoid arthritis, your immune system is autoimmunely attacking your joints. So that when you have rheumatoid arthritis, you generally have a genetic predisposition to it, and you're making antibodies that are going against your joints, and you can do a blood test for that where you see rheumatoid factor. And you tend to get redness and swelling in joints, and it tends to be joints on both sides of the body. If you have a severe acute joint inflammation on one side of your body only, you have to make sure it's not Lyme disease. And if you have chronic pain in one joint of your body and it's on one side and not the other, that's generally osteoarthritis or an injury. But if you have bilateral pain in the same joints on both sides, that could be a rheumatic condition. Also, if you have pain in your hands, if you have pain in your hands and you have a lot of pain in the DIP, so if you're watching Facebook or Instagram, the rheumatic conditions, autoimmune conditions, tend to affect the hands. It affects the joints that attach your fingers to your hands. Those are called the metacarpophalangeal joints. And it affects the joints, the first joint of your fingers, which is your proximal interphalangeal joints, or PIPs. If you have arthritis that's affecting your DIPs, those are your distal interphalangeal joints, those are the last joints on your fingers, that's generally osteoarthritis. That rheumatic conditions generally spare the DIPs. So if you have it there, you probably don't have a rheumatic condition. And you'll have more pain in joints that you use more. I mean, that's generally true anyway, but you'll tend to have more pain if you're, if you have just osteoarthritis, you'll tend to have more pain and swelling on your first finger and your index finger and your middle finger, and maybe in your thumb as well. And your thumb doesn't have, I don't know if you call the joint in the thumb the proximal or the distal interphalangeal joint, because you only have one. You have the metacarpophalangeal, and then you have the one joint. And I guess you could say it's either proximal or distal, depending on your perspective. There's probably an answer to that question. What do you call the distal thumb joint? Might be just called the distal thumb joint. I don't know. So I should look that up. That's something I should know. If you have inflammatory bowel disease, I don't know what the joint in this is the metacarpal phalangeal joint, but I don't know what this joint is. Do you know what it is? Could you find out what the distal thumb joint is called? This joint.
The distal thumb joint.
What is it? What's the proper name for the distal thumb joint? Yeah.
Hang on.
Yeah, thanks.
I'll look it up.
All right. So when you have inflammatory bowel disease, that's generally, you generally have a genetic predisposition towards that. And you can get diarrhea, stomach pain, cramping, bloating. You can get weight loss and anemia and bleeding ulcers. So that you have an autoimmune condition that's attacking your digestive system. When you have multiple sclerosis, that's an autoimmune condition that attacks the myelin sheaths, the coverings of all of the nerves. And you can get lesions in your brain, and you can get lesions in the rest of your body, and you tend to have numbness and tingling in arms, legs, one side of the face. You can have balance problems. You can have visual problems like visual loss or blurry vision or double vision. You can have fatigue, of course, and you can have cognitive problems. Any of the autoimmune conditions can give you cognitive problems, can give you... can give you brain fog. So chronic and acute conditions can cause inflammation. Medications can cause inflammation. So we're pretty sure that when Ron was taking his statins, he was getting joint inflammation from that. Irritants and foreign bodies that your body can't get rid of can cause inflammation. Your body's going to, if I see something that's foreign inside of you, it's going to send cells and compounds to go after those cells. So you can get inflammation just from having foreign stuff. So people who work in polluted conditions, or they work, so for example, asbestosis, the people who work in conditions where they're breathing in fine particulates, so pollutants, you can, if you go outside when the air quality is very bad and there's pollutants in the air, you can get inflammation from that. People who have asthma are going to be more likely to have that happen. But you can get what's called pneumoconiosis. Pneumoconiosis is where you are inhaling foreign fine particulates, and it's causing an inflammatory condition in the interstitials, in the interstitium of your lungs. That's the parenchyma, the part of your lungs that holds up the tubule structure. So it's not in the bronchi, in the bronchioles and the alveoli. It's in the actual lung tissue that's holding that stuff up. So you get you can get silicosis or fibrosis from fibroglass, and you can get asbestosis. Those are all type, and you can get Meyer's lung. That's all pneumoconiosis, and that causes inflammation. There are foods that can cause inflammation. Sugar and refined carbohydrates will increase your inflammation. Because why? Because you have more insulin around. Insulin will, one of its jobs is to create inflammation, so it to produce healing. It's one of its jobs. But if you have too much insulin around, you're going to have more inflammation. Too much alcohol can cause inflammation, basically because when you drink alcohol, you are taking up the resources of your liver to process the alcohol, so it's not as available to process immune compounds and nutrients. And the other thing is that alcohol, when it's metabolized, alcohol is metabolized to acetyl-CoA, which your body uses very easily and can convert to glucose and then uses as fuel. And then when you have too much glucose around, you increase your insulin. So same thing. Processed meats, and so those are going to be meats that are processed and there's nitrates in them. They can cause inflammation as well. And then trans fats, so that's going to be your deep fried foods. So Ron found us the names of the finger joints. The thumb digit has only two phalanges, and so it only has one joint, the thumb interphalangeal. So it's just called the interphalangeal joint. So it doesn't get a designation of PIP or DIP, it's just IP. Right? Is that what it says?
That's what it says.
Yes. So because it's not, it's considered to be neither distal nor proximal.
Okay.
So do you know what proximal and distal mean?
No.
Okay. Proximal simply means closer to the center of your body, and distal means further from the center of your body. So there are anatomical terms that designate, that give you a sense of where you are in the body. So distal means further from the center of your body. So so if you say that there's a bug on my arm and it's crawling distally, that means it's crawling away from my shoulder and towards my hand. That's the distal direction. Proximal means the bug is walking towards my shoulder, towards the center of my body. So if I say I have pain distally on my forearm, you'd expect the pain to be here near my wrist as opposed to proximally on my forearm, which means it's closer to my elbow. So it gives you a sense of where something is in the body. So distal is away from the center of the body. Proximal is close to the center of the body. Then there's medial and lateral. Medial is center, is closer to the midline of the body. Lateral is closer to the sides of the body. So if I say I have a mole and it is lateral to my left collarbone, so that means, okay, here's my left collarbone, and I expect the mole to be over here. Whereas if I have the mole medial to my my left breast, it's going to be here. Okay, and so someone will know to look for it there. So there's medial, and then there's superior and deep. That's superior and inferior. Superior is closer to the top of your body. Inferior is closer to the bottom of your body. So I have a mole that's superior to my nose. It's going to be here. If I have a mole that's inferior to my nose, I'd expect to see it here or here, you know, below my nose. Okay. And then you have superficial and deep. Superficial and deep means it's closer to the outside of your body. Deep means it's closer to the inside of your body. I have a bug in my ear. So a bug that's superficial is going to be looking out your ear hole. And a bug that's deep is going to be crawling towards the eardrum.
Okay.
Yes. And so wounds heal from deep to superficial by first intention. So they start from heal. They heal from the inside out. So that's, they heal from deep to superficial. So that's another direction. And then there's then there's slices. So there's views of the body. So there's coronal, where you're looking at the view from the corona, from the crown. So you're looking at you're looking from the top of the body. If you do coronal slices, like on a CAT scan, the slices go through the head of the, you know, through going horizontally through the body. That's coronal. Sagittal means like an arrow. Sagittum is an arrow, and so that's, so you're looking at the body from the side. So a sagittal view means you're looking at it from the side. So if you do sagittal slices, you're looking through the side of the body. So that's some stuff I learned from Dr. Titchard. May he rest in peace. Okay, so now you know. All right, so that was an interesting tangent. So there are blood tests you can do for inflammation. So if you want to ask your doctor to help you to diagnose whether you have inflammation, there's some blood work that you can do. Also, one of the things that we learned about herniated discs is you see this rare and precious substance that I am drinking? Good to drink it. It's called water.
Or water, as some of us say.
Well, they say water in Queens, and they say water in Greater Philly. So what do you say?
I say water.
Water. And there's water. You know,
there's an R involved.
Yeah, it depends. It depends where you are in the country or the world, because if you're in England, you're going to say water. So yes, there's an R involved, but it depends on how you pronounce it.
If you're in France, you say aqua.
In French,
you say aqua.
Yeah, I say aqua. That's true, and in Latin as well, and in Spanish you say agua. Mm. And you know what you say in Hebrew?
I don't know. Pass me a beer. I don't know what.
Who's the actress that plays Amy Farrah Fowler?
Oh, I don't know.
You don't know?
No. It's Maya.
Right! You said it!
Bialik. Yeah.
What does Maya mean?
I don't know.
Water,
I guess.
Right? It does. That's Maya. Maya's name is Water. So it's an odd name, but see, for somebody to be called Water in English in the United States is not such a big deal. It's really not a big deal in Britain either, because we've got plenty of water through most of the United States. Not so much where Stephanie lives in Arizona, but we have a lot of water here. So you might not name somebody Water, but naming somebody Water who lives in the desert is a big deal. So for her to be called Mayim as a Jewish woman, Mayim is a huge deal. Mayim is something you celebrate when you live in the desert. So Mayim has a lot of symbolism and joy surrounding it. And and something that you celebrate. You pray for rain in the rainy season. So anyway, so it's actually kind of an honor to be called Mayim. And I'm pretty sure Mayim Bialik has a lot of stuff she does around honoring the fact that her name is Mayim. She had some teaching that she did around going to mikveh, which is the Jewish ritual bath. Anyway, so so drinking water is another one of the things that nice Will Harlow said, is that people don't drink enough water, and that if you want to rehydrate your discs, you gotta drink water. Now, you can drink, and if you drink mostly plain water, that is a good thing, but it's also fine to drink it in other forms. Maybe not alcohol, because alcohol is dehydrating, but if you do a little, definitely if you do tea, and definitely if you do tea without caffeine, that's going to help to hydrate you. I drink Tulsi tea at night. You can drink any kind of herbal tea. If you drink, water with a little lemon, and if you drink seltzer water. And contrary to what everybody thinks, caffeinated beverages aren't actually dehydrating. What caffeine does is it relaxes the detrusor muscle of your bladder. So when your bladder, you feel the urge to go to the bathroom more when you're consuming caffeine. It's not because it's actually a diuretic. Diuretic is something that actually causes your kidneys to release fluid from them. You may feel like you're releasing a lot of fluid because you drink like a 16-ounce cup of coffee. And then now you have the 16-ounce cup of coffee. You have a lot of fluid going through you. And now you have a relaxed detrusor muscle. So you're running for the bathroom. But it's not technically a diuretic. There are other things that cause diuresis. And so, for example, dandelion leaf will cause diuresis. Hydrochlorothiazide, the drug, causes diuresis. Immersing yourself in water causes diuresis. Remember that trick that you do at the pajama party where you stick somebody's fingers in water and cause maybe an accident? Well, that's very simple. It's because you're causing vasoconstriction in their body, which raises their blood pressure. It makes the kidneys want to lower the blood pressure, so it does that by wanting to release more water. So if you immerse yourself in water, go swimming, especially if you immerse yourself in cold water, you may find that you have to go to the bathroom more. And then if you drank a bunch of fluid earlier in the day, you're going to be going to the bathroom even more. All right, so blood tests that help to diagnose inflammation. One of them is serum protein electrophoresis. So serum protein electrophoresis helps to confirm chronic inflammation. It measures certain proteins in the blood. If there's too much or too little of the proteins, it can point to inflammation in either direction. So that's kind of interesting. C-reactive protein. So there's C-reactive protein that's used to track general inflammation, and there's cardiac C-reactive protein that's used to track inflammation in the cardiovascular system, and they both can be measured. And it's sensitive for inflammation, but it won't differentiate between chronic and acute inflammation. It won't necessarily tell you where the inflammation is coming from. And SED rate is sort of a quick and dirty way to test for inflammation. ESR is erythrocyte sedimentation rate. And what it is, it indirectly measures inflammation by measuring the rate at which red blood cells sink in a tube of blood. The faster they sink, the more likely you're experiencing inflammation. And it's measured in how many millimeters per hour the red cells sink. And again, ESR, all it's doing is seeing how fast your red blood cells sink. So when you do the test, we had to actually perform the test when I was in school. And you have a big pipette, and you put the blood in the pipette, and then you watch it, and you time it to see how fast the red cells sink. And you get a separation of red cells at the bottom and white stuff at the top. So the more white stuff you have, the faster you have it, the more inflammation there is, because proteins and stuff tend to be lighter than the red cells. So the more there is and the faster it happens, the more inflammation that you have. But it's a quick and dirty test for inflammation. It doesn't tell you anything specific, just tells me that inflammation is present. You can also test plasma viscosity, how thick your plasma is. The thicker your plasma is, the easier it is for cells to stick together. And so that's a sign of inflammation. And there are more blood tests too, which I'll talk about in a little bit. If you have certain symptoms like chronic diarrhea or numbness on the side of your face, you might get an MRI or x-ray. if you have GI stuff, you might get a colonoscopy or an endoscopy or a sigmoidoscopy, which is just you're testing the most, get this, superficial part of your colon, the part of the colon that's on the way out. Those are the tests you might get. There are things you can eat to reduce inflammation. So I have a whole section on anti-inflammatory food, so we'll get to that in a little bit. So there are things you can do to help to reduce inflammation. There are certain supplements that reduce inflammation, and we can talk about those in a bit. Hot or cold therapy, and especially alternating hot and cold therapy, can be helpful for physical injuries. Exercise as tolerated, you know, more often than not, get an exercise that works for you, whichever one you'll do and whichever one is appropriate for the kind of inflammation that you have. Reduce your stress levels. Anything you can do to reduce stress will reduce inflammation because you reduce cortisol. When you have too much cortisol, you're going to tend to have more inflammation. If you're smoking, you should stop. Smoking causes inflammation. You're inhaling pollutants. And especially if you're smoking commercial cigarettes, it's going to have things like heavy metals in it. And you're just breathing polyaromatic hydrocarbons, which are just, you're breathing burning substances. So you're going to have free radical damage to the inside of your lungs and your breathing passages. And so your body's going to want to try to repair that. So you're going to create more inflammation. Any pre-existing conditions that you have going on, you want to treat those. You can treat inflammation with over-the-counter drugs. Over-the-counter drugs, for example, aspirin, ibuprofen, and naproxen. And you have to be careful how much of these things you take because they do thin your blood and they can cause stomach upset and they can cause bleeding. And if you take too much of them, they can be detrimental to your kidneys. Then there's prescription NSAIDs like diclofenac that you could have prescribed. They can be effective for inflammation, but they can cause side effects and they can cause interactions with other medications. Then there's corticosteroids. And corticosteroids, you might be given those if you have a respiratory inflammation. You might be inserting them into your nose. If you're if you have asthma, you might be inhaling them. And if you have chronic pain and you're given steroids, you might be given pills or you might be given injections. And those really should be done with care and short term because they have a lot of side effects. They can give you diabetes. And if they are wherever you ingest them, they cause breakdown of tissue. Because what did I tell you? When you have too much cortisol in your body, it runs around your body and breaks down tissue, so you have enough sugar to run away from the bear. Well, when you have corticosteroids injected, it's doing the same thing. It will break down tissue and it'll cause your blood sugar to rise, and it also can cause psychiatric changes. It can cause people to become agitated and upset. But especially anywhere if you're using a direct application, so either in your nose or your lungs, or if you're taking them internally, it can cause breakdown of tissue. If you get steroid injections into a joint, you can only get so many because even though they reduce inflammation and you feel better, they break down the joint. So that's why I'm trying to avoid getting injections because I don't want to have that happen. I'm trying to be patient and let my body do its thing. You can get topical analgesics. So they sell topical diclofenac at the store, and they also sell topical anesthetics like lidocaine. You can buy those over the counter at the drugstore, and sometimes you can get topical ibuprofen, so you can put them on a specific body part. So inflammation is a natural part of your body's immune response, but long-term or chronic inflammation can be damaging, and working on calming that down is a good idea. So there's lots of ways to do that. All right, so let me see if we talked about... So I talked about some of the inflammatory tests that you do, the tests for inflammation that you do. We already talked about the SED rate, or erythrocyte sedimentation rate, and cardiac C-reactive protein. There are other tests that you might do. So there's lipoprotein PLA2, which is a very specific cardiovascular inflammatory test. And it's actually a lipoprotein, and it's related to arachidonic acid. And when you see that elevated, you have more likelihood of cardiovascular inflammation. Then there's D-dimer. When that's elevated, that's an indicator that you might have excessive clotting. And D-dimer can be elevated in a lot of conditions. It can be elevated in COVID-19. It can be elevated from COVID-19 vaccinations. It can be elevated if you have an acute blood clot, a pulmonary embolism, or a deep venous thrombosis. It can be elevated if you have cancer, because remember we said if you have a lot of inflammation, it increases your plasma viscosity. So one of the markers for that is the D-dimer, and D-dimer will measure that. So when you see a D-dimer, it's kind of nonspecific, but it can tell you that there's inflammation. They'll also use that. It's sort of a marker for clotting. And so another time you'll see that is when somebody is having about to or having a heart attack or a stroke. So that's another thing you can test. The ANA and rheumatoid factor are tests that you do as autoimmune screens. So ANA is the anti-nuclear antibody, and it is an antibody that if you have a nonspecific autoimmune condition, it will tend to be elevated. And when you see a positive ANA, you then generally go and test for more specific antibodies to see what specific autoimmune condition the person may have. And rheumatoid factor tends to point to rheumatoid arthritis. You can have autoimmunity and not have any of the known autoimmune antibodies positive. That does happen. And they'll say, so you'll be diagnosed with a seronegative autoimmune condition. You can also be tested for immune globulins. So immune globulins will test your immune globulin E. They're known as IgE. They're immune globulin followed by a letter. So IgE, IgA, IgM, IgG. So IgE tends to be elevated if you have a parasitic infection. Also, if you simply have respiratory allergies, or if you have eczema or asthma, they tend to be elevated. IgA is a grocery store. It's not a grocery store. Immune globulin A tends to rest on the surfaces of the body that communicate with the outside world. So it's on the surfaces of your digestive system and your respiratory system. It's a first line of defense. IgG, immune globulin G, is what your lymphocytes get encoded to when they become antibodies. And they sit in your body and they're waiting to fight whatever microorganism or even a food that they have been encoded for. And then IgM tends to be, it's an agglutinating antibody, and it will tend to be positive when you have an acute infection. So say you have acute Lyme disease, you'll see IgM antibodies in your Lyme Western blot. Or if you have even acute strep, you'll see a positive IgM. And the IgM will happen acutely, and then it will drop down, and then you'll have IgG left. And IgG, you can't tell if the infection is current or in the past. And if the person has IgM, has no IgM, but they have IgG for a particular organism, then you assume that that person already had the condition, that it was in the past. So I think that's all. If you have elevated IgM and you're not acutely ill, or you have a long-standing, depending on what level it's at, it could be an indicator for certain conditions, like there's a certain cancer called multiple myeloma that is associated with increased immune globulin M. So there you go. Okay, so let's go to foods. I talked about immune globulin. And then there's complement. And complement is a complementary substance that will rise when you have inflammation. And if you have elevated complement, it can indicate that you have more inflammation. And if you have low complement, that can be that your immune system is impaired. So that's something you can test. So let's find out what in the heck are immune globulins. So I think I went through these. I explained this mostly. So we actually have five. So I already said this, multiple myeloma is associated with having elevated levels of immune globulins. And you can also have low immune globulins. If you don't have enough immune globulins of certain types, you might be given them intravenously. So immune globulins are Y-shaped. So So if you go to the big Y, it's a good place for your immune system. So, yeah.
No.
It's not? Okay.
Unless you're buying really good food.
Yeah, which you could do.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so immune globulins have three main functions. They prevent foreign invaders from entering cells and neutralizing them. They coat foreign invaders to tag them for destruction by white blood cells called macrophages. So the macrophages, we were talking about those before, they are things that clean up messes. And they trigger destruction of foreign invaders by stimulating other immune responses. So the tips of immune globulins have a paratope, and that binds to sections of foreign molecules called epitopes, like a lock and key. And the tip of the paratope, I didn't know that word paratope until now. It has a variable region that allows for your body to produce millions of types of antibodies. So the paratope gets changed, and it becomes antibodies. It gets encoded for specific proteins. So then you have plasma cells, and those are activated B cells. You have three types of blood cells, red blood cells, platelets, and white blood cells. And your B cells are activated to go against certain antigens that we mentioned. All blood cells come from special cells. They're called stem cells. So those stem cells are things that grow inside your bone marrow, and they come from myeloid stem cells and lymphoid stem cells. And lymphoid stem cells can become natural killer cells that kill cancer cells and viruses. They can become T cells that destroy infected cells, and then B cells, which become plasma cells. And those are so B lymphocytes are the ones that get encoded and become antibodies. And we already explained IgM, IgG, IgA, IgE. And then there's IgD, which we don't really know what it does, and it may help to be a receptor on beta cells. So in the field of medicine, your doctor may recommend testing. They look to see if you have too many or too few. And if you have an autoimmune disease, you're going to have too many. And if you have too little, you can have an immune deficiency. So you might get your immune globulin levels tested if you have a serious infection, if you have a medication side effect, kidney disease, burns, and malnutrition. They can all cause low immune globulins. And you can get high immune globulins if you have autoimmune disease or hepatitis or cirrhosis. But that is, your liver is scarred and not functioning the way that it's supposed to. If you have a chronic infection, and like we said, we talked about multiple myeloma before, if you have allergies, you'll get increased immune globulins. And also if you have inflammatory bowel disease. You can have an antibody deficiency disorder. Some people don't produce enough immune globulins and don't produce typically as they should. They can present shortly after birth with a lot of infections. And you might have to get intravenous immune globulins for that. And then if you have an autoimmune condition, you produce immune globulins against your own cells, then that's called molecular mimicry. So IVG is used to treat these conditions. So there's a number of conditions like autoimmune thrombocytopenia, where you have low platelets, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, where your blood cells are going after your red blood cells. We have Guillain-Barré, which is autoimmune destruction of nerves that control breathing. And chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, which is CIDP. So that's sort of like multiple sclerosis, but it's primarily peripheral, and you get autoimmune cells that destroy your myelin sheath on your nerves. And immune globulin tests will be used, like the IgA test helps to, you'll do that when for some kinds of leukemia, kidney damage, intestinal problems, and low IgA at birth. And there are conditions like MUGIS, where you get monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance. So I'll test people and they'll have high IgA, and you have to monitor them to make sure they're not turning into cancer. Sometimes they just stay elevated and you don't know why and you can't figure out why. And you have to monitor them to make sure it doesn't convert to multiple myeloma. And then there's autoimmune diseases as well, like rheumatoid arthritis. IgD, they really don't know what it's why it might be elevated, but maybe multiple myeloma. IgE will tend to be elevated in parasitic infections, allergic reactions, asthma, atopic dermatitis, which is basically eczema, some cancers, some autoimmune diseases, and sometimes multiple myeloma. IgG will be elevated in Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, which is a specific kind of excessive immune globulin illness, in leukemia, kidney damage, and also if people have HIV infection, and MUGIS, like I said before, monoclonal gammopathy, you don't know why, multiple myeloma, and hepatitis and multiple sclerosis. And IgM will be that just gets elevated acutely in any infection, but if it's persistently elevated, it could mean you have multiple myeloma or leukemia or MUGIS or Waldenstrom's and all these other conditions, hepatitis, mononucleosis, and other autoimmune conditions, kidney damage, also even a parasitic infection. And then there's thyroid-stimulating immune globulin, which you don't see very much. I keep testing for it, and you don't see it, but if somebody has that, they tend to become, it will be higher in people who have Graves' disease, which is an autoimmune hyperthyroid condition. So so that's all your stuff about immune globulins. So we're going to need to wrap up because it's about that time. And so we'll talk about ways to help inflammation next week. And so so we talked about what inflammation is, and now we're going to talk about how to get rid of inflammation or reduce inflammation next week. And there's some great ways to do that. So we'll talk about foods and supplements and other things that you can do to reduce inflammation. So you've been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can email me or airmail me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM. WHUS Stores and WHUS.org.